dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Who better to get an intelligence briefing from than a man who was, for part of a very distinguished naval career, the chief of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He is now a retired Navy captain. His name is James Fennell, and I believe him to be one of the most thoughtful and prescient analysts of what Communist China is up to, specifically in the military space, but much more broadly as well. He is a founding member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, with which I'm also associated, and it's a great delight to have him back with us at Secure Freedom Radio. Captain, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk.
Great to talk to you, Frank.
Well, I wanted to get your sense, Jim, about what this Belt and Road Initiative is all about. It was showcased, of course, in Beijing yesterday in a forum that brought together many leaders of various nations which are engaging in or will this program of Xi Jinping, the president of China. What is he up to, and what is it likely to mean for them and for us?
Well, Frank, the Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI, is essentially part of Xi and the Communist Party's grand strategy to essentially put China in control of the world's geopolitical system. And in the case of the Belt and Road Initiative, it's focused on economic, integration across what they call, the old Silk Road. And the belt or the maritime Silk Road, if it goes through the seas, through the Indian Ocean and up into the Mediterranean. And now they even have a polar Silk Road. And so the idea is to use all of China's comprehensive national power, and in this case, these agreements with these countries to insert themselves in economically to make themselves essential to these nations that are in bad economic straits, maybe need infrastructure, maybe don't have the money to do the things that they need. And China comes in and offers these things. And then once they get a foot in, are now able to have influence into the decision-making process of those governments, influences their votes in things like the UN and other world international forums, and essentially becomes proxies of China through non-military means in a way. But there is a military element of it, which is that in these places where there are ports, that the PLA Navy won't be far behind to be able to help provide quote-unquote stability should that arise. And so this is the concern, is that it's like tentacles of an octopus. It's just reaching into every corner and region of the globe.
And as you understand, as a naval professional, what goes along with the access to, and ultimately, I think it's reasonable to expect, the control of these ports and other strategically located infrastructure in key countries, particularly many of them choke points, is, of course, an ability to project power and do so perhaps decisively against nations like ours, no?
Correct. And I think we need to, sometimes when some of these folks that analyze these things focus narrowly and accuse people of conflating different issues and that they're unrelated. But I would say, for instance, we just saw this week the report of the French Navy transiting to the Taiwan Strait and the Chinese government condemning France and saying, you're going through our territorial sea and territorial waters with your warship, and we don't agree with that. Well, if that's happening in the Taiwan Strait today, is it possible that in the future China will take the same kind of attitude and say the Strait of Hormuz, or in the entrance to the Red Sea and up the Suez Canal, where their base in Djibouti could, you know, essentially block that, because they want to claim that because it somehow influences their global Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah. To say nothing of the Panama Canal, which they happen to control at both ends. And Jim, you know, I mentioned the Committee on the Present Danger a moment ago. We had a fantastically interesting program involving members of the committee and others in New York City, where we talked with the financial community and business leaders there about one other piece of this Belt and Road program and the Chinese agenda more generally, and that is we're financing it. We're making it possible. We're enabling it, and therefore we're complicit in something that is really mortally perilous for our interest and perhaps for our security as well.
I think that's the most significant element of what what we're talking about, which is this money that the Chinese are getting and that the expansion of their economy to help it sustain its growth rates, which keeps Xi and the Communist Party in power, ultimately goes into funding their military, which is expanding across the Pacific and into these other areas, which is a direct threat to our security. And as a former naval officer, it's a direct threat to my shipmates afloat.
Amen. We're going to be talking more about the results and insights of this particular program. I did want to just mention, as I did in my commentary, that I think an extraordinarily important insight was given to the audience by Steve Bannon, the former strategic advisor to President Trump in the White House, to the effect that, as Lincoln put it, we are in a global house divided, half free and half slave, and such a house cannot stand. He was talking specifically about the enslaved people of China and what's in prospect here, enabled by our financing, is the extension of that servitude China has in mind for the rest of the world through this Belt and Road Initiative and its other machinations. It's extraordinarily important that we understand this and we stop underwriting this danger. As a seasoned naval intelligence officer, let me ask you about what would the implications be if the Chinese are able to develop a dominant capability to operate in the deep oceans?
Well, this recent reporting of Chinese oceanographic survey vessels and their submersibles operating at great depths and in different areas around the Pacific that has come out this week, the implications are that China has clearly devoted themselves to trying to master and gain control of the undersea domain. They have a ways to go. America still has great advantages there, but we should not deceive ourselves that the Chinese are pursuing this for a variety of reasons, the first of which is to be able to operate ballistic missile submarines that will allow them to have a capability to strike the United States with their ballistic missile submarines. Secondly, many of the world's communications capabilities run across the Pacific, for instance, through some of the islands in the South Pacific are key hubs that essentially provide New Zealand and Australia information. These cables and these places could be cut off with Chinese activity.
Jim Fennell, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. There's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you come back for an extended visit soon. Next up, Bill Gertz takes us inside the ring right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our tour inside the ring with one of the best tour guides, certainly of the puzzle palace of the Pentagon and the ways of the national security community in general, in America Today. He is, of course, Bill Gertz, the author of a column by that name and at the Washington Times. And, of course, he is senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, the author of 7 best-selling books on various national security topics, including most recently IWAR, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, it's good to catch up with you, my friend. As always, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, we started a conversation that I want to continue with you, Bill, with Jim Fennell in the previous segment, concerning what China is up to, not simply in the Western Pacific with island building and naval forces and the like, but in the deep ocean realm, apparently with considerable help from Ms. Deep, something to that effect, a prominent American oceanographer. Tell us what the Chinese are up to, as you understand it, Bill, and the implications of their activities.
Yes, this was a story in my second most recent Inside the Ring column, which looked at the fact that China is not only militarizing outer space and cyberspace, but is also looking at, in a sense, inner space by going into militarizing the deep space, deep sea. And this is was based on a revelatory military report that I got a hold of, a Chinese military report that was translated into English, and it talks about setting up exotic weapons and using the stealth, difficulty in tracking items in the deep sea, which is about 3,000 feet and deeper. And so they're looking at going beyond just conventional submarines, but looking at really militarizing the deep sea.
In that connection, Bill, is it conceivable that they are stealing a significant march on us technologically and perhaps strategically as well?
Definitely. We've seen reports that the Chinese have invested large amounts in developing deep sea vehicles, that is, vehicles that can go to the bottom of the sea, which is, you know, up to 4 or 5 miles deep. And they're looking for ways to leverage this as an asymmetric warfare tool. Again, the target is the U.S. The Chinese view us as their main enemy, and all of their military efforts, contrary to many of our intelligence assessments for years, but they're only focusing on Taiwan, they're actually focusing on the United States and how to defeat the United States in a future conflict.
And that's the point, of course, of what the Chinese are up to across the board, and we ignore it at our extreme peril. Bill, the Russians seem to have something of a similar agenda in mind. They don't have anything remotely like the Chinese resources, and their focus seems primarily in the nuclear weapons space. Tell us about their latest submarine-natured threat.
Yeah, just this week, and this was a Free Beacon story that ran this week, was Russia unveiled one of its new, what Vladimir Putin has been calling their super weapons. And this is a new submarine that's designed to, described as a special purpose nuclear-powered submarine that's designed to carry what the Pentagon is calling, codenamed the Canyon. It's a high-speed, megaton-tipped underwater drone that is basically designed to blow up entire ports and port cities in the United States. This is, again, this is not a theoretical threat. And, you know, the U.S. has nothing like it. These weapons that Putin has announced and is, in fact, building are not covered by any of the arms control treaties that we have, including the New START treaty. And so this is a fairly alarming development. It's going to challenge our strategic command and our Pentagon policymakers on how to basically deter Russia with nuclear weapons. You know, we're in the midst of modernizing our nuclear forces, and this is going to be a multi-year, multi-billion dollar buildup of modernization. And yet, the Russians have unveiled three or four strategic nuclear weapons that we have no counters for, and which the Russians are specifically designing to defeat our missile defenses, at least according to their own official state media statements.
Well, and as you say, Bill, also to defeat our arms control agreements with them by circumventing or simply violating, I guess, the New START treaty that Barack Obama negotiated. How exactly does that work? I'm not quite clear. They've got nuclear threats to us, and yet they're not going to be covered or counted or otherwise impinged upon by the New START treaty?
That's right. The New START treaty only covers existing weapons in three categories: land-based missiles, sea-based missiles, and bombers, and air-launched nuclear missiles. And for any new systems, Russia is obligated under the treaty to come to the New START negotiating mechanism, a consultative commission, and basically include those. And the Russian government has announced no way. They have no plans to include any of these new weapons. Again, they have this nuclear-tipped drone. They have hypersonic nuclear missiles. And they also have a new nuclear-powered long-range cruise missile as well.
This raises a question, Bill, about the confidence that some Americans continue to repose in arms control as a way to mitigate dangers to this country. I think it's fair to say one of them is Representative Adam Smith, who is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. He has made clear, really, his determination to move the United States towards a minimal deterrence posture. I'd call it even subminimal. It's downright reckless, but it's born of this idea that if we simply exercise this kind of constraint on our weapons programs and deployments, the rest of the world will follow suit, that with or without arms control treaties will set the example. I can't imagine a more harebrained idea, frankly, more counterfactual in terms of our long, hard experience with totalitarian and other dangerous regimes. Notably the Russians, as you say, they're in the process of circumventing one agreement and violating the INF and others. What is Adam Smith up to, and what seems to be animating him, as best you can tell?
Well, Adam Smith is the new chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, and his statements and views in recent weeks since assuming that position have indicated that he is taking the committee to the hard left, which is also, I think, kind of a reflection of the entire Democratic Party on national security affairs, is they're moving sharply to the left. Smith is a vehement anti-nuclear advocate and is opposing the development of the new smaller nuclear weapons, which was announced in 2017 for the Nuclear Posture Review as a needed step to counter both Chinese and Russian small nukes. He's also even challenged one of the fundamental new strategy, which has pretty broad bipartisan support, on China. He said in one case that he doesn't think the United States could compete with China. And yet, again, there has been a growing consensus, as you're aware, and the Committee on the Present Danger has highlighted on the need to counter the growing threats from China. So this is a real problem. Hopefully he will wake up and get some better advice from his advisors, and hopefully get on board the need to build up our forces under the Trump administration. We're back to peace through strength, and we're moving ahead with that. And that is clearly the safest and most effective way to prevent any kind of a conflict in the future with either China or Russia.
Well, let's hope that if that doesn't work out, that he will be rendered irrelevant by some more sensible people in the congressional process. Bill, let me finally turn to a story that you had just today, as I recall, about another Chinese spy in our midst, this one in the State Department. What do we know about her?
Yeah, this is this week, a former State Department official named Candace Claiborne went through a plea agreement with the Justice Department. And basically, as a result of that plea agreement, she pleaded guilty to minor spying charges, even though, according to the statement of facts made public in her case, her court case, she had been spying for the Chinese intelligence service, that is the Ministry of State Security, and its Shanghai State Security Bureau, which is the dedicated Chinese unit focused on spying on the United States, since 2007. And she was paid more than $550,000 for secrets. Now, she wasn't charged with espionage because she insisted, and again, one of the charges against her was that she lied to investigators. She insisted that she did not pass classified secrets to China, only internal State Department secrets on such things as the strategic economic dialogue and other internal State Department matters. But it sounds to me like they did a plea deal. She's agreed to cooperate in a damage assessment, and they're trying to prevent the disclosure of how seriously damaging this case was.
If this were the only example of Chinese espionage and gathering of our secrets, it would be bad enough. But Bill Gertz, you've done a superb job, as you do on every issue, but particularly of raising our awareness to the extent to which the Chinese are using so many different vectors, including, you know, their nationals in our colleges and Confucius Institutes and, you know, tech theft operations in our laboratories, in other government-sponsored activities to essentially steal us blind. And this cannot be allowed to persist. Bill, on that and so many other scores, thank you. Come back to us again next week if you would.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's a delight to say we're joined once again by Joseph DeGeneva, a great prosecutor, former special counsel, a man who has served his country in both the Department of Justice and on Capitol Hill with great distinction, and is rendering arguably an even more important service these days as he helps the rest of us through various media outlets, including this program, to make sense of what is going on with, among other things, the collusion delusion, as it's been called by President Trump, and now the argument that, well, that might not have operated, but there is evidence of collusion begetting obstruction, and that will now become the object of the next witch hunt. To talk about all of this and more, Joseph DeGeneva, let me welcome you back. Good to have you, sir.
Great to be with you.
It's now passé, I guess, to talk about collusion. Only the diehards like Adam Schiff seem to still be intent on pursuing that will-o'-the-wisp. But we're told that the Mueller report lays out a pretty persuasive case, even though he didn't, of course, bring it on in a criminal sense, that the president was determined to obstruct the effort to ferret out what he was up to in the collusion department. Walk us through this, Joe, please. Sanity check.
Well, the Mueller report, or more aptly, the Andrew Weissman report, Mueller's chief deputy report, is quite frankly a joke. It is one of the worst pieces of material ever produced by the United States Department of Justice. It is an embarrassment to most of the people in that building, and everybody knows it. The fact that they found no collusion is not a surprise. Bob Mueller knew that within 2 months of his appointment, but he pressed on in an effort to create an obstruction case against the president of the United States for impeachment. And for that, Bob Mueller is a disgrace to the department, and he's going to have to live that down no matter what, how many nice editorials he gets from the New York Times and the Washington Post. And let me give you two examples of why the report is totally corrupt. In the volume one, which deals with collusion, they lie, literally lie about two people, Carter Page and George Papadopoulos. In the report, they make it look like Carter Page was actually working with a couple of Russian Secret Service agents, spies, when in fact, and they describe him in such a way that they make you think that Carter Page worked with these people, and then these two people, these two Russians, were indicted and convicted in New York. What they don't tell you and what they don't imply is that Carter Page was an informant for the FBI and helped convict those two agents. But they make it look like that none of that happened. It's absolutely disgraceful. It should never be a part of a public report. That's the first example. Second example is George Papadopoulos. In George Papadopoulos's case, they say, quote, that George Papadopoulos made early contact with Professor Mifsud. Now, we all know now that Professor Mifsud was a CIA FBI asset who had been put upon George Papadopoulos to get him to say things that he, Mifsud, would then feed back into U.S. intelligence to be used to get a FISA warrant against guess who? Carter Page. In fact, Mifsud was put in contact with George Papadopoulos. George Papadopoulos didn't make early contact with Mifsud. He was asked to do so by another CIA asset, a woman. So two major examples of deception by Mueller, trying to make people look guilty when they're not. And then the final coup de grace is, we now know that because there was no collusion, and that was readily findable, the reason Mueller was appointed was to make sure that all the illegal spying that had gone on for more than 4 years prior to that, which has already been reported on by the FISA court, was never found. Well, too late. It's been found. And the next stage of this is going to be a major criminal investigation by the Attorney General, Bill Barr, and we'll see where it leads.
Let's come back to that, Joe Geneva. I just wanted to dwell for a moment, though, on what you say certainly sounds right to me. And yet, what we're witnessing is clearly the pivot by the Democrats in the House of Representatives, if not Nancy Pelosi herself just yet, certainly others in her senior leadership, as well as the rank and file, for impeachment proceedings to be opened to go after the president on the grounds that Bob Mueller has documented whatever it is, 10 or so instances in which the president expressed his desire or even exercised his authority to order people to obstruct the investigation. You find this uncompelling, I know, but what should we make of the argument that's being advanced by the left?
Well, it's part of a disinformation campaign, not by the Russians, but by the Democrats. They want to dirty up the president of the United States. They know they're not going to be able to impeach him. So they want to play fake impeachment, have hearings, get people come in and testify, have them say things that they told Mueller. And the president is going to exert executive privilege for all of these witnesses. And there's just going to be a long court battle over getting those people. But this, make no mistake about it, this is a political act being committed by Adam Schiff, Elijah Cummings, and the other people, Jerry Nadler, in order to try and just smear the president. They know that there's no there, but it doesn't matter to them. Their purpose is to dirty up the president. He's a fighter. He's going to fight back. By the way, this notion that somehow he obstructed justice is absolutely ludicrous. If he had wanted to fire Mueller, he could have fired him. That would have been used by the House Democrats as a basis for impeachment or impeachment light. The truth is, he didn't fire Mueller. He let him complete his investigation. Mueller published his report. The president didn't invoke any privileges so that Bill Barr could send the report to Congress in redacted form. So the notion that somehow there was an obstruction is absolutely ludicrous. However, the Democrats are going to argue that there was, and they're going to do whatever they're going to do publicly. And it's going to be a huge waste of time. And most of Americans have moved on from this. And I think the Democrats are doing a lot of damage to themselves. And I wish them nothing but ill will.
Well, I assume that it's reciprocated towards you, Joe DeGeneva, because of, among other things, the clarity that you're bringing on these matters and the unstinting way in which you speak your mind about what's actually afoot. Let me turn to the thing that you did mention a moment ago, Joe, though, that is the one possible saving grace out of all of this, and that is that, as Dinah West has documented, I think, very impressively, and as you have in your various analyses, what has really been criminal here is the effort to, well, effect a coup d'etat against first the campaign of the president. But once he became president, even during the transition to his presidency, really a formal effort to take down his presidency. This does demand investigation. I know on this program and elsewhere you've said that's what's coming. Certainly it sounds like it's what Bill Barr has in mind. Could you just give us an update on how you think that's playing out at the moment?
Well, two things are going to happen within the next 6 weeks. One, I am informed that there's going to be a separate special report on James Comey from the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, Mike Horowitz. That, I am told, is going to be quite devastating, and it will provide the Attorney General, who will be briefed well in advance and probably already has been briefed on the contours of that, with additional ammunition for a federal grand jury to investigate all of the original actions taken by the FBI under Obama and the Department of Justice under Obama. The second thing that's going to happen is Michael Horowitz will issue sometime in late May or early June his report on the abuse of the FISA process. I expect him to make major conclusions about that and to make some criminal referrals about people who abuse the FISA process in a criminal way by providing false information to that court and by misleading it. It is very important for people to understand that the FISA court, which has been subject to some, I think, unwarranted criticism, has already made a report on this to the Attorney General. On April 26, 2017, Judge Collier, who is the chief judge of the FISA court, issued a scathing 98-page report on FISA abuse by the Department of Justice and by senior Justice Department officials, including Sally Yates, the Deputy Attorney General at the time, and John Carlin, the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the National Security Division, which has responsibility for FISA.
Was this made public at the time, Joe?
Yes, not at the time. It was made public about a year and a half ago by the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats. The court lays out in very stark terms 4 years of illegal spying by FBI contractors. There are four FBI contractors. They are named in the report, but they have been redacted and they are not public, for gaining access to data about American citizens, which is the most highly sensitive classified information about electronic surveillance that the NSA holds, took that information and used it for leaks and for unmaskings by people in the Obama administration. That is already on the public record. There is no way, given that court's report, that there cannot be criminal indictments of everybody involved in that process.
Well, let me just press you on this one point, because when you last visited with us, you reminded us of Susan Rice's butt-covering memo on her way out the door that implicated Barack Obama himself in no knowledge of, and it seemed approving of, everything that was done here, which was, quote, by the book, unquote. Not so, of course, as you say, and now the FISA court has said. But Joe, does that mean that he himself might be in some jeopardy, Barack Obama?
Here's what I think is going to happen. We know from the Susan Rice memo, and that memo was written for one reason only, to provide a justification for all the illegal activity which occurred before President Trump was inaugurated. It's a cover your fanny memo in the sense that it says, we did all this and we had a reason to do it. This is what the defense is going to be of Comey and Sally Yates and John Carlin and McCabe and Strzok, that they reasonably believed that the Russians were in control of some or all of the Trump campaign. That, of course, is ludicrous. This was designed to cover up the illegal spying that had gone on for 4 years previously. But the criminal justice process will work that out. As far as President Obama is concerned, it's quite clear not only from that memo by Susan Rice that not only the President Obama knew, but Biden knew, and that they had been informed of that by John Brennan, the CIA director, James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, and James Comey, the FBI director.
Joseph DeGenova, thank you so much for spending some time with us. As always, it's deeply appreciated, as is your continuing service to our country. Keep it up, my friend. We're going to talk with Mark Krikorian right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It is a pleasure to say, joined by a friend and colleague who I admire greatly, not least for his own work, of course, but also for that of the organization he leads. It is the Center for Immigration Studies. Its executive director is Mark Krikorian. He is a published author. He is an essayist. He is a just unbelievably indefatigable contributor to the public policy debate about immigration issues, and specifically the security implications of getting them wrong. He is with us to talk, I'm very pleased to say, in the aftermath of some rather dramatic developments on the border. That's, I guess, something that happens most days, actually, Mark, but it's particularly striking that we've had Mexican military personnel on the U.S. side of the border disarming American military personnel, And I want to explore with you what on earth that is all about and what President Trump is proposing to do in response. Welcome back. It's so good to have you, and thank you for finding a few minutes to talk.
Well, you know, glad to be here. And that incident near El Paso was really remarkable because it has happened in the past that there have been, you know, honest mistakes and confusion, especially on the land part of the border from El Paso out to the Pacific where there's no river. And a lot of those places, even now, there's no barrier of any kind. In other words, not even like a little vehicle barrier 3-4 feet high to keep trucks from driving over. And so sometimes you may well not know where the border is, but this isn't that situation. This was in the Rio Grande. So these Mexican soldiers had to have crossed the river and then walked like up an embankment to get to the place where two of our soldiers were. And it just doesn't smell right. Obviously the Pentagon is looking into it.
Yeah, especially as the reporting suggests that these Mexicans were simply confused as to where the border was. It's hard to believe that that would be the case if they had to get across the Rio Grande River, right?
Yeah, it seems absurd.
It seems misleading. Let's be clear. It's downright deceptive to be making that argument. So what happened next when they got over there and they came across these two U.S. soldiers?
Well, they basically surprised them. I mean, they came upon them so quickly that our guys couldn't even get a distress message out to, you know, wherever they were working with. And they didn't have rifles. They just had one of them just had his sidearm, but he was disarmed until, you know, I don't know what happened. They explained what was going on. I'm not sure of the specifics. They're looking into it, obviously, carefully looking into it. But it seems to me very unlikely this was anything other than an attempt to facilitate some other kind of illegal activity. And again, I don't know this for sure, but this is, you know, it seems to me likely these guys were probably being paid off by cartels to distract the, you know, our guys so that somewhere else nearby they could get something nefarious over the border. I mean, that seems to me pretty likely what was going on.
And we can only speculate about what that might be. But knowing what you do, Mark Krikorian, about what the cartels are up to, that could be anything from migrants to drugs to even perhaps weapons of mass destruction and terrorists, no?
Sure, it could be anything. And that's the whole point. You don't know what it is. It's most likely was drugs, if that's the scenario is correct. But the whole point is you don't know. That's why you have border enforcement, so you know what's coming across the border.
So this comes at a moment when, of course, as you know better than just about anybody, we are confronting across a broad front, well, 2,000 miles or so, for that matter, a host of challenges arising in part from not having a secure border, a crisis, the president has called it, a national security emergency. And we've seen this compounded by, you know, the catch and release policies becoming even more necessary simply because of the excessive numbers of people with children and so on that are coming in. This is being now responded to by President Trump, this particular incident, I guess, in part, but also this larger set of circumstances by further deployments of military personnel to the border with arms. Is that right?
Yes. And that's okay as far as it goes. I mean, I'm not second guessing the president at all. But the core issue of the border emergency we're facing, in other words, the main reason it is an emergency, is driven by our ridiculous loopholes in our immigration and asylum laws that make this catch and release policy unavoidable. And that's not just a problem because of the illegal immigrants who are, you know, released. It overwhelms our system. So the Border Patrol, you know, if it encounters, say, a group of 200 Central Americans that flag them down and surrender to them and say the magic words, asylum, I fear being returned to my home country, basically everybody on the Border Patrol shift in some of the more remote sectors has to go and babysit these people and, you know, bring the kids water and blankets and deal with the hospital and all of that kind of stuff. Well, guess what? The entire rest of that sector doesn't have anybody watching it. That's the real danger here.
Right. Well, plus the treatment of those individuals, humanitarian and all as it is, only further reinforces, does it not, the incentive to get here. So we're watching that magnet effect continue to operate. So enter Jared Kushner, Mark Krikorian, the president's son-in-law, whose portfolio seems to extend to all manner of things, including now, we're told, coming up with a comprehensive approach to immigration reform that will try to fix some of these things, or not, or do other things. Just quickly, Mark, you've been through these wars for years and years. What has been the past history of these kinds of efforts to effect immigration reform?
Well, I mean, yeah, every one of these so-called comprehensive immigration reform efforts has crashed and burned. And there's always been one basic reason for it. No one trusts the assurances that we're not going to have another amnesty 10 years from now.
So amnesty would be part of a comprehensive reform. Is that necessarily the case?
By definition, it is. Now, this isn't necessarily what Kushner is going to roll out, but because he's probably not going to have an amnesty component in this plan. But the thinking is, and I've actually talked to people in the White House, is that when they present it to Congress, the Democrats will add an amnesty component, and they're anticipating and expecting that. So the reason those things always fail is not amnesty itself. I don't like it. It's distasteful. But clearing the decks of old mistakes is something people can be made to understand. The problem is no one trusts the political class not to just let the same problem build up again, and we'll have another 11 million illegal aliens. That's the core issue. Not the 11 million who are here now, but the next 11 million that the rocket scientists who run our government and our society will basically allow into the country.
Right. And again, the magnet effect of the simple expectation that there will be an amnesty either in the near term or further ones coming in the future, Mark Krikorian, inevitably compounds the impetus behind more people wending their way here. And again, Mark Krikorian, you and the Center for Immigration Studies have done an extraordinary job helping us understand the kind of people who are doing that. It's not just individuals who are seeking a better life or, you know, trying to get away from violence in their home country or what have you. It's all kinds of folks, including people from parts quite removed from Central America, that are making their way here with perhaps very malign intent. So this gives rise to a question, Mark, on the sort of political side. And I know you don't do politics, neither do I, but it touches upon our world and our responsibilities. Donald Trump's base, I believe, will go nuts if Jared Kushner comes forward with a comprehensive plan that looks a lot like the ones that have crashed and burned, as you say, in the past, but would have, you know, Donald Trump's imprimatur on it, and he would be implicated in it. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no question about it. And the president gets that, I think. This is why the talk about Kushner's plan, which, as far as I can tell, isn't even necessarily finalized yet, but the broad outlines of it, I mean, I basically know what they're going to do. We've talked to him about it. He's presenting it to the president next week. That's what all the talk is about. It doesn't mean the president is going to say, hey, great, Jared, let's go with this. You know, I think it's entirely possible that the president is going to do what he already did once with a plan that Kushner offered him on immigration, which is, you know, nice work, Jared, but you got to get back to the drawing board and come up with something that isn't going to blow up in my face politically.
Mark, we have to leave it at that. Keep up the great work at the Center for Immigration Studies, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.